waiting for the next Snowden. Today, Friday, February 14th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The author of a new book about the NSA leaks recalls a time before Edward Snowden, when WikiLeaks was still the big story.
We thought this will never happen again in our lifetime. And then you fast forward 2.5, 3 years, and not only do you have an even bigger data dump, you have top secret and above top secret.
So what comes next? And later, a Russian grandmother's edict against cold drinks.
She just treated a glass of ice water like it was a weapon of mass destruction. Like, God forbid I should defy her.
Plus, residents of Jerusalem write love notes to the parking police. This man says it's part of the Jewish tradition of negotiating with God.
So if you can negotiate with God, why not with a traffic officer?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There have been so many revelations based on Edward Snowden's leaks and so many stories about the NSA snooping, it's hard to keep them all straight. I mean, how do we write that first draft of history when the history is still unfolding? This week, the National Security Agency added a new wrinkle. In a letter to Congress, the agency revealed the resignation of an NSA civilian employee who admitted giving Snowden access to data he shouldn't have. Snowden had previously said he didn't steal any passwords or trick his coworkers, so you can see the difficulties author Luke Harding must have had gathering information for his new book. It's called The Snowden Files. Harding is a journalist with The Guardian in Britain, and he says it's still not possible to paint a complete picture of this saga.
We still don't entirely know how this extraordinary thing happened. We know what happened, that Snowden's swiped a huge number of kind of documents from the NSA servers in Fort Meade while sitting in Hawaii and fled to Hong Kong. But really, I think the agency has been on the back foot trying to figure out how he did it, whether it was passwords, as you suggest, whether it was the fact that he was just extremely clever, extremely good at what he did, and whether actually the NSA itself was kind of sleeping on the job.
No, your book, The Snowden Files, is really kind of the first pass, the first accounting of what happened last year with Edward Snowden and the NSA. What was your goal with kind of trying to consolidate all the whole saga?
Yeah, well, the Guardian's editor, Alan Rusbridger, kind of called me to one side and really asked me to put it all together days after Snowden outed himself in that incredible video, which I'm sure practically everyone has seen by now from Hong Kong. And
sure,
I think
yeah.
He felt and I felt that this was a sort of historical moment. I mean, obviously, there will be other books on Edward Snowden, but I, it seems to me it's a kind of it's something very special. It's something epochal. And Snowden was the guy, whether you see him as a hero or a traitor, who pulled back the curtain, if you like, and kind of revealed the true nature of things, how things really are in this digital age, that actually pretty much of all of our private communications are not really private. They're all being collected and stored and sifted.
Now, some of the details in your book, like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras meeting at a hotel next to a plastic alligator on the lookout for a man with a Rubik's Cube, I mean, it almost seems made up. What details for you still don't make sense or which you still feel need clarifying?
Well, I mean, there are a few gaps in the timeline for sure that we didn't get to the bottom of. We don't know a huge amount about his time in Japan before he moved to Hawaii. But I think the thing that most puzzles everybody is how he ended up in Russia. He was in Hong Kong. He met with Glenn, with Laura, with you and my colleague. He went underground for a couple of weeks. And then he boards a flight to Moscow, where he was staying and hiding, why precisely he went for that routing. It's not entirely clear. I asked Snowden's lawyer, I met with him, and I said, look, what happened? And he just said, it's complicated. And I'm sure we will find out, but at the moment, there's no proper answer on that.
By the way, do you speak with him regularly?
Well, it's a little bit sensitive, but can I just say that we, as in The Guardian, we are in touch with him, yeah.
So what about your own ability to process a story? I mean, The Guardian is part of the story. How then do you approach the story? And is that a hard act to pull off, to be the rigorous reporter on the story when you are part of it?
Well, it was a kind of Guardian story from the beginning. I mean, the Guardian broke the first NSA story on June the 5th last year, when we published the first Snowden document, which showed that Americans' phone records are all being secretly collected, which actually no one knew a year ago. So this absolutely is Snowden's story. And I wrote it rather like a thriller, if you like, because that felt like the most appropriate genre. But it's also the story of the journalists who interacted with him, actually under quite tough conditions, because we were coming under pressure from some very powerful agencies, from the White House, and in the UK, in particular from the British government, which was very, very angry about this leaks and more or less threatened to throw us all in jail.
So where does this whole narrative of Edward Snowden, the whole story, where does it sit now and where does it go from here?
Well, Snowden's situation is tricky. When he says he hasn't cooperated with Russian security services or given them his material, I believe him, not because I'm naive, but because it was kind of, for Snowden, it was sort of mission accomplished in Hong Kong. He'd shared this material with some senior journalists whom he trusted. But his options are no options. I mean, the Europeans are furious, but actually neither the Germans nor the French nor even, you know, the Scandinavians have offered Snowden asylum, so he can't go there. Meanwhile, if he goes back to the US, it's pretty clear that he will face espionage charges. So I think by default, he's stuck.
Do you think there will be more whistleblowers? I mean, we've got, you know, Snowden, who's kind of painted himself into a corner in Russia. Julian Assange painted into a corner in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I mean, what happens now with these types of people who want to say something about what's going
on?
Well,
I think inevitably there will be more because of the kind of the era we live in, that we live in this kind of world of big data, of massive volumes of electronic information. If you think about sort of leaking material, say, in our grandparents' generation, you know, you might be able to stuff a few secret documents into a battered brown leather satchel and kind of sneak out, right? But Snowden took tens of thousands of documents. I mean, he swiped huge amounts of kind of information. And so it's a different world. It's a different world. I mean, I worked on the WikiLeaks story and looked at the documents which Chelsea Manning had got, these US State Department cables in 2010. And there were a lot of them, a quarter of a million secret cables. And at the time, we journalists, British, American journalists, German journalists, we thought this is the story to end all stories. This will never happen again in our lifetime. And then you fast forward 2.5, 3 years, and not only do you have an even bigger data dump, you have top secret and above top secret. So I think the spy agencies, I think they're still reeling. They'll be looking at ways of shutting this down so it never happens again. But my feeling is sooner or later it will happen again.
Guardian reporter Luke Harding's new book is The Snowden Files. Luke, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Zeynep Tufekci joins us often to talk about technology and society. Zeynep, we wanted to catch up with you to talk about the extent of NSA surveillance revealed by Edward Snowden and the journalists he's working with, and specifically whether there's a generational difference in how people are reacting to the revelation. So let's just establish our own generational biases here. I'm 52, and how old are you?
I'm 42.
42. Okay, so there we are. Those are the bookends. So I was on a college campus last week doing a little talk and was surprised with several Q&A sessions. No one asked anything about the NSA spying program or Snowden's revelations. None of it came up until I brought it up. Some said they just didn't feel worried by any of it, even though they're all connected by Wi-Fi to this universe. Is there a generational difference?
Well, I would say I find the same thing when I talk to my students or when I do surveys. The people that you're most worried about when you're 19 or when you're 15 or even, I guess, in your early 20s are either your peers, your friends, what do they think about you, or people with direct power over you. So they're worried about their coaches, their professors, sometimes their parents spying on them using these technologies. But the government spying on them as a concern almost never comes up unprompted in my conversations with, you know, their generation.
I mean, I asked some of them, didn't you have to read 1984 in high school? And did that worry you? And they said, yes, we did, but it doesn't worry us. It's bizarre.
But they don't live in a world of 1984, right? The 1984 is a world of a totalitarian state where people are being dragged in the middle of the night and, you know, cages of rats are being placed around their heads. So 1984 is misleading. If that was happening, if there was really truly state terror, they would be worried too. I think part of the reason they're not worried is that they live in a modern democracy. They feel like citizens, and the threats posed by NSA surveillance are a lot more subtle.
I mean, some of the kids said that 9/11 changed a lot in terms of privacy versus security. I can't argue with that. But they also pointed out that they were only 4 or 5 when 9/11 happened. So it wasn't like they're reacting to a before and after kind of scenario. They only know the after.
But again, the powers that they're most concerned about are the ones that they encounter in their day-to-day lives. The state for them is an abstraction. I mean, I think it doesn't even cross their mind as much. And why should it, right? There's no interaction between them and their everyday lives and some database in Utah which might be scooping up every click. But it has no consequence for them as far as they can see.
Why do you think it seems inconsequential? Because, I mean, you teach at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Obama was there last year talking about government grants for college education. They know their connection to the government.
Yes, but they have not had the experience of a government that has used surveillance in a way that's directly observable to them. I mean, even here comes another generational thing, right? Things like the Watergate scandal, which exposed a lot of government spying and surveillance being used against domestic dissidents, scared the previous generations. I think to get scared of government surveillance, you have to have a direct experience of it. And that's not what we're facing. So it requires a lot more thinking through and understanding and some historical and political memory to fear the true threat.
Do you find exceptions to this, like in China,
yes,
because of the extent of spying is so well known?
In places like China, in places like my home country, Turkey, which just passed a massive internet surveillance law, the level of awareness and wariness of government surveillance is very high. When you talk to people in Turkey, it comes up immediately. They assume the government's spying on them. People are wary of them. People are thinking about what to do. And it's true also in a place like China, where people are really concerned about it. And because they've seen the direct power of this kind of surveillance. And I think that's what we haven't come to grips with. I mean, when I teach about the NSA surveillance, the students are horrified. They didn't know it. They don't like it. I mean, the idea that they're just fine with it is certainly not true. They don't like it. They wish it wouldn't happen. But they can't really get their mind to grasp it. And it's just easier for them to say, well, I hope my government doesn't do anything wrong with it, and kind of shrug and go on.
Zeynep, always great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We'll be hearing from young people themselves as we continue our reporting on this issue. But in the meantime, give us oldsters your take. Do you see a generational divide in the way we react to the NSA revelations and government surveillance? Share your opinion, especially you millennials out there, at PRI.org. Okay, we have time for a quick note before the break. The World Press Photo of the Year Award was announced today. It went to American photographer John Stanmeyer for a nighttime picture of silhouetted African migrants on a beach in Djibouti. They're holding their cell phones up to the sky to capture an inexpensive wireless signal from neighboring Somalia. Gary Knight, founder of the Seven Photo Agency, chaired the award jury. He calls the winning image a hopeful photo.
I have no idea what the photographer meant to represent. I have no idea what these men were thinking at the time. But for the jury, the way the jury responded to this photograph was that it was a moment of hope born from despair.
Another jury member praised the picture for portraying the migrants as dignified instead of bedraggled and pathetic. Stanmeyer took his prize-winning shot for National Geographic, and you can see it, you should see it, at PRI.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. No matter where you are, if you're a woman, you've most likely encountered harassment in one form or another. Whether it's a comment from a man on the street or, in the worst cases, outright sexual assault. Not many men know how that feels. The gender roles are reversed, though, in French filmmaker Eleanor Pouriat's Oppressed Majority. The short film packs a punch. It portrays a man named Pierre going about his day in a society where it's the women who dominate.
I wanted to begin the film with just slight remarks, things that aren't usually noticed by people and by men, actually. And it's getting worse and worse, and it goes from laughter at the beginning to a kind of a fright at the end.
Right, with the police woman to whom the man who's been assaulted is giving the report, she almost doubts him. And this is something I gather that a fair number of women go through when they report a sexual assault.
Yes, actually, I don't think it's a usual cop behavior, but I wanted to have in the film a behavior of doubt towards this experience the man, woman has in the film.
Eleanor, what pushed you to make a film that flips everyday sexism on its head with women doing the harassing of men? What started this?
Actually, I didn't want to make a militant film, which would be like a moral lesson telling you bad guys with no humor. I thought it wouldn't reach its point. So I always think that humor is a good way to make people understand what you feel, and as an artist, I mean. So that's why I imagined the swap genre. Mm. Because first, it's funny. Yes, people laugh when they see a topless jogger, for example, in the street. And the film begins with a topless jogger, and it's very funny because it's unusual. And that's the point. Because things are surprising, then we notice them.
How big a problem is sexual harassment in France?
Actually, I don't have numbers, but the problem is more that sexism is like deep inside mentalities, and it pervades everywhere. Okay, there's sexual harassment, but there's sexism everywhere, in every level of society. Mm. And the problem is that women are considered as a minority. That's the absurd thing.
In France?
In France and everywhere, yeah. Everywhere in the world.
You made this film 5 years ago, and it's only now that it's getting lots of views on YouTube. Why did it suddenly go viral?
Actually, yes, I made the film in 2010, and it was selected in a few festivals, and it won a few awards. It was bought by a French TV, so I couldn't post it on YouTube the first 2 years. And then I decided to post it because there weren't many festivals or channels interested in a feminist militant film, so I decided to let people make their own opinion. And I posted it last year. Nothing really happened. 100 views, something like that. And last January, it just, I don't know what happened. And it began, the buzz began in France. And then I posted the subtitled version. And wow, it went crazy.
Eleanor, before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you about the end of your film, Oppressed Majority. Just before the credits roll, you dedicate the short film to a certain Aurélie B. Who is she?
Yeah. Aurélie was the daughter of very good friends of mine, and she got killed by her ex, her boyfriend, who thought she was his. He was his propriety. So it was important for me to dedicate this film to this girl who died because of violence and sexism.
So there's a very personal kind of underpinning to your making this film. Is that what prompted you in the first place, that event?
No, not that event, because it occurred just before I shot the film. But actually, the reason is my everyday life as a woman in France. My witnessing this experience.
French filmmaker Eleanor Pouliot, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
If you haven't yet seen What All the Fuss is About, we've posted Eleanor's film, and beware, it includes some graphic scenes. It's at PRI.org. Okay, now imagine a country with a political system very different from America's, where a political crisis blows up one day, a new government is formed pretty much right away, and the voters have no say in the process. That pretty much describes Italy at the moment. Roberto Dalimonte is a professor of political science at Guido Carli University in Rome. So help us figure this all out. Who's in and who's out suddenly, Roberto?
Well, the person that supposedly is going to be the next prime minister is a very young man. He's 39 years old. He's presently mayor of my town, Florence, and his name is Matteo Renzi, and he's not even a member of parliament.
So how can this happen without voters going to the polls to elect a new prime minister?
Because in a parliamentary system, it is possible to change the prime minister and even the composition of the government. You don't need an election in the parliamentary system to do that. The voters choose the members of parliament. The members of parliament choose the government. So the members of parliament can make a decision to change the government if they want.
And remind us who Matteo Renzi replaced as prime minister.
Matteo Renzi replaces a member of Matteo Renzi party. His name is Letta. He has been prime minister for about 10 months. The party now is in the hands of Matteo Renzi, and Matteo Renzi has claimed to become prime minister because he thinks that he can reinvigorate the performance of the government.
He seems to be pretty popular in Italy. Is that right?
He is popular because he's young, and he has promised to bring to power a new generation of leaders, younger people. He's very dynamic. People believe that he embodies the kind of revolution that Italy needs. The real surprise is that Matteo Renzi has decided to step in the position of prime minister without an election.
How do voters feel about all this happening without an election?
There are mixed views because this is a big change compared to the original game plan. Many of Renzi's supporters are bewildered, are concerned. Some are upset that he has tried to do that. Others feel that this was necessary to get out of the situation of a limbo. The Letta government was not very effective. So it's mixed views, mixed feelings. And only if he does well, only if he delivers change and not just promises, he will be able to keep alive his political career.
Roberto Dalimonte with Guido Carli University in Rome. Thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, parking illegally in Jerusalem. Yeah, it's a thing. Everybody does it. And they leave friendly notes for the parking police. And get this, it works. They often leave without a ticket.
Dear parking inspector, the meter is broken. Please excuse me. And I sign it. Thank you very much.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Okay, you hardcore Olympic watchers, coming up this weekend is a two-man bobsled competition. The U.S. once dominated this event, back-to-back gold medals even, except that was at the 1932 and 1936 Olympics. Americans have not won gold since. But as the world's Jason Margolis tells us, the U.S. bobsled team in Sochi has a new weapon to help it end that drought. You might call it the ultimate sledding machine.
In our sport, every hundredth of a second is a hundredth that much closer to a medal or a hundredth that much further away from a medal.
If you look at the last Olympics in Vancouver, second, third place were separated by 1/100 of a second.
That's the difference between winning medals and losing medals.
Those are American bobsledders in a promotional video produced by BMW. Essentially, they're telling BMW why they've put their faith in German engineering. or rather in the North American arm of a German multinational. That's the way global companies operate these days, right? The engineer tasked with building Team America's sled is Michael Scully. He works just outside of Los Angeles. He knows what it's like to go fast. He's a former race car driver. He'd never gone 90 miles per hour down a curvy, icy track, though. So when he got his new assignment, he went for a ride.
I just was simply not prepared for how quickly those forces happen. The sleds come onto a corner with such an immediacy. I mean, it's almost like you're in an accident each time.
Just spend a few seconds watching a video taken from a bobsled pilot's perspective, and you get what Scully is talking about. One American bobsledder described it as being shoved in a trash can and tossed down a mountain. Scientifically speaking, 5 Gs are pushing down on the bobsledder. Unscientifically speaking, that's a lot of force. After 3 years of testing and tweaking, redesigning and testing and tweaking some more, BMW unveiled a sled that is smaller and sleeker, made of lightweight carbon fiber.
It really is a culmination of hundreds and hundreds of these little nuanced changes and optimizations that sort of come together and create an efficiency. Hopefully that's equal speed.
Scully and BMW won't reveal the exact changes they made. They don't want to give away trade secrets. They actually can't change all that much. Bobsleds still have to comply with size and weight regulations. Still, Darren Steele, the CEO of USA Bobsled and Skeleton, is excited about the tweaks to the new sleds, but he doesn't want to overhype it.
If it was just about the sleds, we'd sweep the medals, and I would say that's not a prediction I'm willing to make.
Steele says the two most important parts of bobsledding remain steering and the push, what the athletes bring to the table. Engineer Michael Scully agrees, but he says once the Olympians have his 375-pound sled moving along, his design team's work can shine.
If you have a great push, that can be facilitated by improved ergonomics. Are there things that we can do that really optimize that path that their feet take, for example, when they jump in there in a split second and reach their kind of final position?
It's the little things that can peel off those precious milliseconds. Scully is proud of the sled's aerodynamics, too. The team to beat in Sochi will be the Germans. They've won gold in the two-man bobsled at the past 3 Winter Games. Darren Steele with Team USA gets the irony if this is the year they dethrone the Germans riding in a BMW.
I can tell you that when we brought the prototype out last year and it proved to be pretty fast, BMW, you know, the German team was asking them, hey, when are you going to build us a sled?
And if the Americans don't win, it's back to the drawing board. Hey, maybe they'll give Ford or GM a chance in 2018. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Lots of ice at the Olympics, at the venues anyway, but if you're in Sochi and you order a Coke at a restaurant, you'll probably get it served to you with no ice, even if the drink is warm. Water, same deal. Kind of weird for a country associated with fur coats and current conditions in Sochi aside, lots of snow. So why don't Russians like ice? We asked Russian-born journalist Alina Simone to explain that for us.
I think that it's actually an attitude that dates back more to my grandmother's generation. She just treated a glass of ice water like it was a weapon of mass destruction. Like, God forbid I should defy her and take a sip of the ice water at a Chinese restaurant. And then a week later, come down with a headache or a cold or like athlete's foot or anything, because the cause would be crystal clear. It was because you took the sip of ice water.
And so it was a cause and effect thing? It wasn't anything like right in the moment, it tastes bad, it hurts my teeth, it's going to make me throw up and not digest my food. What's the reason?
Well, I mean, I think that most Russians who hold this attitude feel that it causes illness. You'll get a cold, basically. But, you know, I did this little mini investigation where I went to Brighton Beach on the hottest day of summer, and I got this very wide range of response. You know, one guy said, well, it waters your drink down. And I said, okay, but why don't Russians put ice in water? And that really stumped him. You know, that kind of ended that conversation. And another person said, well, you don't know where the ice came from. You know where the water came from usually if you're getting it from the faucet or, you know, a bottle with a label, but you have no idea where the ice came from. And so I don't know. You know, that could be. But I think that the health issue is the predominant concern.
Right. Those were your findings from your little anecdotal investigation in Brighton Beach. In Russia, I gather that even in Sochi, that ice has had an impact on the Olympics.
Well, I dispatched a fellow writer friend of mine, Steve Futterman, who is a correspondent for CBS. I sent him to the McDonald's in Sochi to try to get some ice, and he came back, you know, 15 minutes later, we were online and reported no ice at the Sochi McDonald's.
Mission not accomplished.
Mission not accomplished, but that the NBC commissary does serve ice and that people are joking that it's the only place in Russia that you can find ice. That's the report from Sochi. But when I dug a little bit deeper into the history of the ice trade, I found that Americans had sort of this sinister incentive to peddle ice, and that, you know, perhaps we're really the weird ones, and in that many countries, in addition to Russia, do not like to ice their drinks.
Right. I was going to say, I think most of the world doesn't like ice. Like in West Africa, ice is rare in most places because it's just usually for keeping food and medicine cool and not for consumption. So it might even have all sorts of biology growing in it. Why do you think Americans love ice so much? What's going on with Americans' incentive to push ice?
When I looked into it, I found that the ice trade was invented by an American, by Frederick Tudor in 1806, and that almost every ice-related invention comes from an American. The icebox, the first refrigerator car. Nobody knows who invented the ice cube tray, but the first mass-produced refrigerator with an ice cube tray was developed by an American. So I'm starting to feel like, you know, it's a capitalist thing. We want people to buy more ice.
But ice is our friend, right? I mean, it keeps food longer.
Well, sure. But, you know, I was on a flight this weekend and found myself shouting at the stewardess, no ice, because I just wanted to thwart this insidious plot to reduce my quotient of tomato juice to like this thimble-sized proportion. You know, I was reminded of my grandmother and I was kind of like, yeah, I'll take my lukewarm tomato juice. Thank you very much.
And is that your usual approach to ice, Alina? I mean, generally your feelings about ice are don't dilute it. How do you feel about ice?
I'm pretty pro ice in moderate quantities. I've got some ice water here in the studio. I feel like in moderation, you know, I mean, now that on the airlines, they don't even provide you with pretzels and that tomato juice is my sole source of nourishment. I'm like very greedy about volume and I don't want any ice in it.
Journalist and frequent contributor to The World, Alina Simone. Thanks very much. Stay cool.
Thanks, Marco.
Okay, so no ice for drinks in Sochi. That's not holding the Canadians back. They've picked up a bucket load of medals and a surge of patriotism. But because it's Canada, there's been a little linguistic tiff, too. Here's The World's language editor, Patrick Cox.
The Sun News Network has been described as Fox News North. Like Fox, it has its targets. It doesn't like big government. It doesn't much like Canada's promotion of the French language. And it really doesn't like the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, which every Canadian is watching right now because it's broadcasting the Sochi Olympics. On Monday night, the people at Sun News decided they would make some news. Host Brian Lilly brought onto his show linguistics expert Harley Sims to talk about how the CBC was pronouncing names, the names of medal winners, French names, like sisters Justine and Chloé Dufour-Lapointe. What Lily and Sims didn't like was that CBC announcers were pronouncing those names in too French a way. Here they are with Sims speaking first.
It's so selective and arbitrary of what's politically correct and what isn't.
I'll stick with the way we pronounce the names in English, and I will still say congratulations to Justine and Chloé Dufour-Lapointe.
The two of them went on like that for several minutes. What they were doing was classic Canadian rhetoric. It's like playing the race card here in the U.S. If you want to start a political fight, or if you just want attention, you play the language card. Not surprisingly, word got out, and by the next day, it was the talk of the talk shows.
Should we be saying Charles Hamlin or Charles Hamelin, Justine Dufour-Lapointe or Justine Dufour-Lapointe?
Don't make fun of people because they're last name.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
The outrage grew. People called Sun News' Brian Lilly a redneck, and all kinds of other things I can't repeat. Much of the anger came from Canada's largely French-speaking province, Quebec. That proved all too much for Lily. Okay, so this is when Canada's Sun News stops sounding like America's Fox News.
I want to apologize.
It turns out that some of Lily's best friends are from Quebec. That includes his wife, he told his audience, and he has relatives who are native French speakers.
The Olympics are about the athletes, and our Canadian athletes have been doing a stellar job. The focus should be on the athletes and the sport that they're playing. It shouldn't be on dividing Canadians language by language and trying to set French against English. It's not what I intended. It is what happened. And therefore, I apologize.
Moral of the story? Don't play the language card during the Olympics, a time when Canadians of all stripes seem pretty happy about being Canadian. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
We're going to stay with Quebec, Quebec City, that is, where it's in the 20s today. Pretty balmy for one of the coldest cities in North America. But the cold doesn't keep Quebecers hunkered down at home. In fact, the city's just wrapping up its winter carnival, 2 weeks of partying outdoors in below freezing temps. Reporter Valerie Hamilton discovered Quebec's secret recipe for keeping warm.
Everyone loves a parade, right? But standing in 2 feet of snow at 5 degrees Fahrenheit with the wind blowing, you might love it a little less. In Quebec, that's where caribou comes in. Caribou, as in the reindeer with the furry antlers, the animal is the namesake of Quebec's favorite wintertime outdoor party drink.
It keeps you warm, and so you can continue to watch the parade. That's why we drink it.
When it's really cold outside, and it often is, people here say caribou is liquid sunshine. The name is not a coincidence, says folklorist Jacques Dupuy.
It used to be a mix of alcohol and caribou blood. But they changed the recipe because some people were not very into blood, you know.
Despite this checkered past, or maybe because of it, caribou is something of a cultural icon in Quebec. There's even an official Carnival Time Caribou Museum where Dupuy is the musical entertainment. It's crowded with people this afternoon, singing along to the words, "Caribou knocks me out, but love wakes me up again." Romantic, right? But the star attraction here is the drink itself. Richard LeBlanc is manning a busy bar.
But on a Saturday like today, we could go like 600, 700, 800 glasses like this.
People bundled up in down coats and fur hats are lining up for little steaming plastic cups of what looks like mulled wine. But LeBlanc says what's inside has more of a kick.
One, it's okay. Two is perfect. Three, you're getting close to danger. You're going to make the angel in the snow, and maybe you'll do things that you hope no one's going to take on picture and on Facebook or these things.
So if there's no blood in caribou anymore, what is in it? There's just one official producer, but the label on the bottle is not much help. On one side, a herd of caribou in the snow. On the other, it says it's an authentic Canadian fortified wine of, quote, Aboriginal origin, 22.9% alcohol or about 46 proof. Ingredients?
Well, wait, let's read. Wine, alcohol, natural flavors, and something else.
Alcohol. I don't know.
We don't know what kind of alcohol. I think it's hot wine and alcohol mix.
Does anybody know the recipe for caribou?
No.
The recipe for the official stuff is, in fact, a trade secret. But who cares? At carnival time, the streets of the old city are lined with bars sculpted out of ice, where bartenders in parkas serve caribou shooters from ice shot glasses. Some people bring their own in hollow plastic canes topped with the head of Quebec's official carnival snowman.
You unscrew his head, you pour the drink in, and then you walk around on the street drinking that caribou out of the cane.
Steve Gaudreau leads historical tours of Quebec City. He explains that caribou blood thing, a simple misunderstanding. Back in the day, French trappers would add hard liquor to barrels of wine to keep it from going bad. Native people saw the color and thought the trappers were drinking blood.
Because that's what it looked like. And the name kind of stayed, and then it became just a cultural thing to drink in the winter. And now we have this caribou drink that people can make themselves. A lot of people do.
As for the ingredients, he says, caribou, like winter, is what you make it.
My personal recipe, I take a nice Merlot wine or a nice Bordeaux wine, not too strong, usually two-thirds of wine, one-third of brandy, and I add, personally, a little bit of maple syrup.
For the World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Quebec City, Canada.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One country where Valentine's Day is not widely celebrated is Israel. But reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem has noticed that year-round, Israelis do write love notes of a totally different kind.
A few years ago, I started to notice all these little notes stuck on cars. They're scribbled on scraps of paper and wedged in windows, or they're typed out and propped up on dashboards.
Okay, here, like this one. Traffic cop, I'm unloading merchandise.
They're love notes to parking cops. The most famous kind of note even has its own song. Some comedians recorded this a few years back. It goes, "Officer, I'm unloading merchandise. I'll be right back. Don't give me a ticket." Israel's a tiny, crowded country with not enough parking spots, hence all the illegal parking and the note writing, which has a pretty standard format. Begin with a courteous greeting, "Dear officer." Explain why you're parked illegally and why that's okay.
"Dear parking inspector, the meter is broken. Please excuse me." And I sign it, "Thank you very much."
And why you do not deserve a ticket.
"Dear ticket giver, please do not give me a parking ticket because I live here and there is always football matches and I can't park anywhere. Thank you very much, kindly, the neighbor."
These are my friends Karen and Deborah.
And you have to be like really, really especially nice. So it's all "dear" and "thank you" and "love" and "here's my phone number."
I want to appeal to them.
You want them to like you?
Yeah, I want them to like me.
That's the point of a love note, right? To get someone to like you. But love notes to parking cops are totally different. You try to get him to like you so he'll go away.
"My name is Yaniv. Yaniv Avraham. It's funny. You have time that the note, it's really help. And I'm not write a ticket. But you have a funny note that you see the note and you know, I must write a ticket."
I have to say, I have been waiting for this moment for many years. This moment to talk to a real-life traffic cop in Jerusalem. Because since 2011, I have been taking pictures of what I call love notes to traffic cops. So I want to show you my photo collection of notes, and I want to see if these are some notes that you've seen before. Okay, this one says, "Dear honorable traffic cop."
"I'm very honorable before the ticket. I'm honorable. After the ticket, you know, my name is not..."
You're not so
not
honorable after
microphone.
You give the ticket.
Yeah.
When you see a note like that, "I'm dropping my kids off at kindergarten."
"We know that you have a problem parking on this place. We not give a ticket."
He says it's not fair to ticket a parent when everyone's dropping off kids and taking up all the parking spots. But then he says there are times when people try to pull rank. They'll write notes like, "I'm the pharmacist at such and such pharmacy." Subtext, "I'm important. Don't give me a ticket." This officer says he does. I show him some other notes that I've photographed over the years.
All right, I think we're getting to my favorites. These are the kinds of notes that you can only see in Israel. "Honorable cop, we're sitting Shiva. We are mourning for someone who has died at so-and-so's house. Here's the address. Please don't give us a ticket."
"Okay, in situation like this, we not give a ticket. The manager say before..."
He says every day parking cops get a list of where families are observing the Jewish week of mourning. When parking spaces run out and visitors park illegally, they don't get ticketed. So there you have it. In Israel, you can convince parking cops not to give you a ticket.
"Why are the Israelis prone to negotiate their traffic violations?"
Yaron Ezrahi is a leading political theorist in Israel, who also writes notes to parking officers.
"In America, there is a great respect for rules because of a deep commitment to equality. There are no exceptions. The Jewish state has an image of itself as an extended family."
The idea being, Israelis argue with a parking officer like you'd argue with your sister. Then, Israchi says, there's Jewish tradition itself.
It started with the great tradition in Judaism of negotiating with God. There are several cases in the Bible of negotiations. So if you can negotiate with God, why not with a traffic officer?
But think about things from the traffic officer's point of view. He's not God. He's just doing his job. And the traffic officer I met wants people to know that traffic officers can be nice guys, too. When he's out on the streets and helps people fix a flat tire, he uses it as a teaching moment.
After I help for the people, I say that I am cop, and remember, I'm not only give a ticket.
And that's his reply to all those super sweet, I hate what you do, go away, love notes that Israelis leave for him on their cars. Dear motorist, I'm looking for some love, too. For the world, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Here's another note Daniel found. Dear human, if I'm in the way, call me. You can see that one and lots more notes at PRI.org. Okay, as long as we're being creative with our love notes, how about some notes to peace and understanding as well? That'd be a great way to advance the Mideast peace process. It'd also make a pretty nice song.
As I walk through, as I walk through.
Yeah, I know. It already is a song. What's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding? Written by Nick Lowe, made big by Elvis Costello. And this rendition shows what can happen when you do have peace, love, and understanding. This one's produced and performed by Israeli multi-platinum singer-songwriter and guitarist David Broza. The singers here are teenage Israelis and Palestinians in the Jerusalem Youth Choir. Broza's goal was bringing Israeli West Jerusalem and Palestinian East Jerusalem just a little bit closer together.
Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
As I walk on through troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes.
David Broza has been exploring East Jerusalem on his own for the past 15 years. It's a place many Israelis just don't go. But Broza connected with a Palestinian composer, became friends, and started hanging out at his studio in East Jerusalem. That's when Broza got the idea to make these two Jerusalems more like one place. The result is his just-released CD called East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. It also features some original songs, but this cover just seemed appropriate today. So a happy Valentine's Day to you, and here's to all the great things love can bring. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back on Monday.
The trusted, and where is the harmony, sweet harmony, 'cause each time I feel it slipping.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org. The Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org. The Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.